Scaredy Cats. For this extra special bonus Halloween episode, we have Heather Wixon, writer and managing editor for the Daily Dead News, joining us to talk about her upcoming book, Monsters, Makeup, and Effects, Volume 1. Heather has contributed to a who's who of horror websites and magazines, so I'm super excited to have her join us today. And she's also going to share with us her essential Halloween movies. Heather, thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's the best time of the year, so I'm really excited.
It really is, isn't it?
I'm trying not to cough, which is even better. I just took a sip of coffee before we talked. I was like, oh, wrong pipe. So,
oh no, that's not good.
But yes, it's definitely, this is our time to shine. So trying to relish it.
So do you have any like Halloween traditions? I know we'll talk about some movies that you like to watch around Halloween, but other than that, do you have Halloween traditions that you like to follow every year?
You know, I mean, I'm a simple gal. So like we do a few of the haunts here in LA. I think this year though, I think we did horror nights here, which this is my 14th year going to horror nights, but my 12th year covering. So
wow.
Yeah, back even before I moved to LA, I actually would come out to LA in October every year to cover Scream Fest. And when I was out here for Scream Fest, I would always go to horror nights also while I was out here. So besides last year, this is our 12th year. We would have been in 13th if we'd had a 2020, but you know, what are you gonna do? And you know, just decorating, honestly, like I just kind of leave on Fear Fest all month. And then just like, you know, and then when it's time to watch movies, then I'll throw on, you know, the stuff that I'm actually intending to watch. But like Fear Fest for me is just sort of like that warm, snuggly blanket that I just can't like live without throughout October. And Shudder is kind of an extension of that too. Cause you know, if it's not great on Fear Fest, then I can like go over to Shudder and see what's on one of their channels. So.
Awesome. Yeah. I love Shudder, especially, well, all year round, but it's kind of my go-to in October for sure.
It is. And it's so great because what's fantastic about it is when it first started, like it had a pretty solid selection, but I've really loved that the way that they've been able to like bring in all these films from around the world that I think most people otherwise would overlook. And I love the fact that they're also digging up some of the cult classics that, you know, maybe we saw once as a kid and then it just kind of like disappeared. So I really love that they've become this go-to hub for all kinds of great new horror, but still celebrates all the stuff that we love and even introduces us to like new favorites too. Like it's, you know, one of my very favorite things. Like I don't know why, but like, it took me a few weeks, like a few months when they first started. Cause I was like, I looked at the selection. I was like, I have most of these movies. And then it was like, they started to gear up with all these acquisitions out of film festivals. And I was like, oh, they're really starting to build up. And a few years later, look at them. Like, it's amazing. And it's great to see a lot of their content being ported over to AMC as well.
I also love the way they curate something. So they'll have different collections. So if you're like, I really feel like I want to watch this particular type of movie, and you can just go and look and they'll be like, oh, here's a whole bunch of zombie movies for you, or like smart slashers. I just really appreciate the way that they take the time to do that.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. Because sometimes I'm a little indecisive where I'm like, I know I want to watch a slasher. Do I want to watch Scream for the 743rd time? Maybe. But in the meantime, let me go look and see what's over there just in case.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to subject you to what we call the Scaredy Cat Five. And these are five questions that we ask every new guest to the show.
Okay.
Firstly, what is your favorite subgenre of horror?
You know, I think for me, my favorite subgenre is horror comedy. I love being scared, but I think I'm at the age where horror doesn't actually really scare me anymore. It just sort of affects me.
Right.
So in a lot of my favorite movies growing up were tended to sort of include comedic elements to them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really where like, that's like my comfort zone. Like I love horror comedies and I think it's a really tough thing to pull off really well because the idea of scaring somebody and the idea of making somebody laugh, they kind of come from the same place.
Right.
And if you can do that, if you could achieve both things from the same material, like to me, that's pretty remarkable. And I don't think that they get enough credit, like horror comedies don't get enough credit for being able to do that.
I feel like they're very underrated for the
most
part.
They are. And I get it. Everybody likes different things, but I always get kind of bummed out when sort of, as I refer to them, sort of the more hardened horror fans complain that there's like too many jokes in a horror movie or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, why not? Like, you know, I want to be able to react to a movie, whether it's like out of fear or because I'm laughing or, you know, because I'm cheering. So yeah, I just, that's one of my favorite, you know, very favorite things. Like I just grew up watching, you know, I always talk about like House 2 and what you talk about and things like that. And like movies like Vamp and, you know, even these days, like Tucker and Dale has become sort of a mainstay in our house.
It's so good.
Yes. Which is a movie I think deserves, it gets a good amount of love, but I think it deserves even more love because that movie is just so fantastic.
It really is. I didn't see it until last year when I did my 31 days of horror challenge. And that was one of horror comedy. And I was like, okay, I want to go with one that I haven't seen. And I'd heard good things about it. So I thought, you know what? I really should watch this. And yeah, I loved it. And my partner, who is horror comedy is his thing too. He's not a huge fan of other types of horror. But when he really enjoyed it too. So I was like, all right, that's an endorsement from him. So,
and it's for me, it has such a great rewatchability too. Mm-hmm. It just, and I love those relationships. Like, I mean, I've always been a huge fan of Tyler Levine, because did you ever watch the show Reaper?
No.
Okay. It's like, I think it only ran for a couple seasons, but it was like a few, maybe like over 10 years ago now. I have zero concept of time anymore. actually I know it was, cause I think it was like early 2000s. But that was a really fun show. It had Tyler Levine and Ray Wise on it. And I really enjoyed that. But then he was also on this show called Invasion, which was only one season on ABC. And I just totally just fell in love with him as an actor. And I just always thought he was so great and so endearing. And I love the fact that they played that up so well with him in that movie. Like, he's the heart of it. Like, I love Alan Tudyk in it, but he is really the heart of it. And it's so much fun. I wish we'd gotten a sequel.
That would be amazing.
I know they were talking about it for a while, but I just don't know what ended up happening with it. So
fingers crossed, it could still happen.
You never know. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've waited longer for sequels before. So
very true.
Yes.
What is your favorite horror movie? And I know this is like the Sophie's choice of questions, but if you had to choose one, what would it be?
Oh gosh. Oh, you know, when I think about the movie that really made me into a horror fan, like I grew up watching horror, like from a very, very early age. But I think the movie that clicked with me that really was like captured my imagination, captured the terror, pushed me, you know, as a young horror fan and kind of pushed, and then, you know, kind of pushed me in terms of what I could tolerate watching and then also pushed me towards wanting to push myself even further. That's a lot of pushing. But I think I would have to go with the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
Great choice.
It's such a basic choice. I know it's because it's like, it's Freddy. Everybody loves Freddy. We get it. But it's for me, like I can still remember everything about like seeing it for the first time because I was 6 when it came out in theaters. So I was 7 when it came out on VHS. And I remember I had a pretty lax mom who just kind of would let me watch anything. And my best friend's parents were really into horror sci-fi. So they would let us watch everything and anything. And I remember when Nightmare came out on VHS, that was one of the movies they wanted to watch first before us kids could watch it, just to make sure that we could take it because it was a little different and there was a lot of buzz about it. And I remember me and my best friend, we were in her bedroom in the back and her parents and my mom were watching the movie in the living room and we decided to sneak out and the couch was like in the middle of the living room and we were like crawling on our hands and knees to watch it. And I remember it was the scene when Nancy's going up the stairs and my best friend Jenna, like when Freddie like pulled a face off through the door, the hole in the door, she like yelped like really loudly and totally gave us up. And our parents were like, go back in the room and blah, blah, blah. So and then it was a while to try to convince my mom that I could take it because it was a pretty extreme movie, you know, especially for 1984, 85. And then eventually I remember I had a babysitter and I was over at her house and somehow she gotten a copy where it was a VHS tape with that and Children of the Corn for some reason that was just taped off the table. And my mom was at work and she was like, well, you know, I was like, please let me watch it. Please let me watch it. She's like, well, let me check with your mom. And my mom's like, all right, fine, whatever. And I was terrified. I remember that night I had to like go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And because of the scene with the wall where Freddie comes through the wall, like, yes. I remember standing at the front of the hallway and thinking, okay, I just have to get to the end of the hallway for the bathroom, but I don't want to touch the walls because Freddie could come out of them. So I just like folded my arms like across my chest and just ran full speed to the bathroom.
I love that. So,
yes, but it was like that was the movie that I was like, wow, like I had seen other horror movies. Like I started at like age, my mom, you know, being a single mom couldn't afford babysitters a lot of the time. So like she would take me to like movies with her. So I went to like American Werewolf in London when I was 3 and things like that.
Wow.
Don't recommend it. but it was a thing that happened. And, you know, like I remember seeing like The Thing at like age 5. And that's from like around the same time I saw Salem's Lot. And, but it was really like Nightmare on Elm Street where I was like, I want to watch as much horror as possible because that was really cool and scary. And then Freddie kept coming back. So of course I had to like see more of that. So that was really the one that kind of kicked off my passion for it.
That's great. I know what you're saying about it being a basic choice, but it's part of horror canon for a reason. So I don't think there's anything wrong with picking that. I had a completely different experience with horror because I had night terrors when I was young. And my parents wouldn't let me watch anything scary. When the Michael Jackson Thriller video came out, I wasn't even allowed to watch that. And I was probably, what year did that come out?
That was also 84.
84, yeah. So I would have been 8 at the time. Ooh. And nope, wasn't allowed to watch it. I remember my bedroom was right next door to the living room, like basically 3 steps from my bedroom to the living room. And then across the hall from my bedroom was the bathroom. And I got out of bed one night to go to the washroom and my parents were watching the video. And my mom was like, no, cover your eyes, cover your eyes. I wasn't even allowed to like get a single glimpse of it. So it wasn't until I was in my, I was 12 or 13 when I first started getting into horror. So a lot of things that were like, would have been, you know, contemporary to people of that age were kind of, I guess, older for me. Like I was older watching them for the first time than most horror fans, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And there's absolutely, you know, that's the great thing about like sort of embracing new things. It's like, you know, everybody kind of like, there's like certain people like who just, they'll say like, oh, you didn't grow up watching horror, then you're not really like a horror fan.
Yeah.
To me, I'm like, I don't care what age you come to it. If you come to it because you watched the Twilight movies, awesome.
Yeah.
You know, if you came to it because, you know, you've been a fan of it since you were 5 years old, that's great too. Mm-hmm. Like there's no right way to be a horror fan. And even my other half, like he jokes about this too. He was kind of scared of a lot of movies and stuff when he was a kid. Yeah. So like, you know, we always joke like one of his favorite movies that we watch every Halloween is Hocus Pocus, which I was a little old for when it came out, but right. I've really come to embrace as I've gotten older.
Same. Yep.
But like for him, like he didn't grow up watching the stuff like I did. So it's kind of interesting because like we always joke about like covers and like video stores that used to scare him. And like he wouldn't watch Dolls because the Dolls cover scared the crap out of him.
April Fool's Day. That cover scared me.
That was another one that scared him too, which is amazing because it is a comedy. Mm-hmm. And there's no death in it whatsoever for real.
Nope.
Which is amazing. But he always talks about that too. The April Fool's Day specifically. I love that you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Because he just was like, oh, the hair was a noose. And I'm like, I know.
To the knife finder. Oh, yeah. Terrifying.
Yeah. So I just think it's great. Like I think what's great about horror is that they're really, regardless of your life experiences or when you come into it or how you come into it, there really is something for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Like with something like when you're going to like straight dramas or you're going to comedy, you don't really get that kind of gamut. Like comedy is comedy, right?
Right.
I mean, there's broad comedy, there's very niche comedy. There's different subgenres of it, but I think horror specifically really offers all of us something different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that like I could watch Nightmare on Elm Street along with 10 other people and we probably all could get something different out of that.
Absolutely.
Which I think is pretty cool. So yeah. I think that's, you know, I think that's ultimately like why I loved it so much is because one, it challenged my own personal boundaries, but it also like really stoked me like stoke the fires of my own creativity in a way.
Right.
That I'm glad it did, because I don't know that I'd be where I'm at today had it not.
I love that. So you mentioned that you saw An American Werewolf in London when you were three at the theater. Was that the first horror movie you remember seeing?
It's the first one I remember. I remember there's little memories I have of like sitting in theaters. That one specifically, because I remember it was my mom's best friend, who was a real big scaredy cat of horror movies. she still is. But I remember sitting in a theater, and the only thing I really remember from that is sitting in the theater and the movie theater scene being on and getting kind of confused. Like, I thought they were in our theater.
Oh.
And I don't know if I was just reacting weird, but I remember my aunt, because I call her my auntie, but I remember her saying to my mom, like, oh, I think Heather's getting creeped out, which actually she was getting creeped out. She's like, so I'm going to take her out into the lobby. So I remember that. Like, I remember like my first drive-in experience was they re-released Blazing Saddles.
Oh.
And I kind of just remember sitting in the back of the car watching that with my mom. And it's funny because like we hadn't really talked about that, but I remember like a few years ago, I mentioned that to my mom. I'm like, did we see Blazing Saddles at the drive-in? And she was like, yeah. She's like, I don't even remember. I don't even know how you would remember that. She's like, cause you were so little. Mm. And I was like, I do. Like, it's funny because I don't think I've only ever watched it like one other time since, but right. I have that sort of specific memory of it. And she's like, we've never talked about that. I can't believe you actually remember. And I was like, oh, I do. But yeah. So American Werewolf was kind of like that entry point where maybe I should have been more scared of werewolves, but I wasn't. Although I love that you mentioned the Thriller video, because one, a lot of there was like a VHS tape that came out for Thriller where it was like the music video and then had the behind the scenes.
Yes.
And that was my first introduction to special makeup effects. I didn't know what that was.
And right.
It also helped me sort of reconcile things in my head a little bit, where I'm like, oh, well, obviously Michael Jackson isn't a werewolf because this guy made him into one. But it fascinated me so much. But the video itself scared the crap out of me. And I remember every single time I'd watch it, and we watched it a lot because my best friend's dad worked for a distribution center in Illinois for Warner, Elektra, and Atlantic. So he would get all of the Warner Brothers entertainment stuff coming through.
Oh, cool.
But they'd also get a lot of other stuff. So they would get like VHS tapes and records and weird promotional items and things like that. Like a few years ago, she gave me a cutout. It was a smaller one. She had a full-size one of Prince on his motorcycle from Purple Rain that they would have in like video stores.
Oh, cool.
And it was like the coolest thing ever. It was. And we like, that was like the best place to hide to when we play hide and go seek. But she also had a smaller one. So she'd actually sent that to me a few years ago, which I probably keep in my office. But I remember like her dad bringing home this tape for Thriller, and like I was obsessed with it. But every time I'd watch the video, the scene when he would turn and his eyes would be yellow, but he was normal, I couldn't watch it. Like, I was good with everything until that
just point. That part.
Yeah. That was the part. I was like, nope, can't do it. and it would just freak me out. And I think I remember watching the video a couple years ago because it was like playing randomly somewhere like on TV or something like that. And I remember I still like had that feeling in my stomach as soon as like he does the turn. I was like, that was like 35 years ago. What are you worried about? But it's still effective. And it's just so great. I think that's the reason it ended up becoming like sort of the standard for music video storytelling. Like, mm-hmm. nobody could touch Thriller.
Yeah.
That's just because of all the amazing people that were involved with it. So, but I'm so glad you mentioned it, because I was obsessed with that tape.
I became a big fan of the video much after it had been out for quite a while, and I was allowed to finally watch it. But in fact, I remember on Halloween a couple of years ago, I was part of a Thriller dance class, and they taught people how to do the Thriller dance.
Oh my God. I love that so much.
It was mostly old ladies. And like, I remember being next to this old German lady. She was probably in her 80s. And I was like, no, do this with your hands.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's awesome.
So who is your ultimate final girl?
Oh gosh. You know, I always struggle between there's two. And, but the thing is, that's great about them is they both come from Wes Craven. Okay. And I think, so it's, I think for most of my life, it was Nancy Thompson. Because I, again, I was sort of a kid who grew up with a, in a single parent home who had to kind of grow up a little too fast.
Right. So you can relate to her.
Yeah. And so her resiliency was something that I really looked up to as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And just the way that she could kind of take on things that, you know, she shouldn't have to, but she was sort of having to deal with it on her own because of the things that the situation that her parents sort of put her in.
Right.
And then as I got older, I fell in love with Sydney, from the Scream series. Mm-hmm. I'm a big, as they say, sort of in the wrestling business, I'm a big mark for Wes Craven, which probably explains why I do a Wes Craven, podcast with my horror BFF, Patrick Bromley. But I remember sitting in a theater and seeing Sydney, and she had been through so much and she could still fight. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of that resonated with me, just on a personal level through things I'd gone through, you know, throughout my teenage years and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have just always loved Neve Campbell since Party of Five.
You know, it's funny. I hated Neve Campbell.
Really?
Party of Five. And then it was when I saw Scream that I was like, oh, okay. I am a Neve convert now.
Okay. Interesting. Cause I know sometimes like if there's an actor or an actress you don't really click with, like maybe you're sort of averse to watching those movies. Cause like I have a really, I mean, I guess this is a weird, example, but like I have like this weird aversion to Taya Leone. I just find her to be too much.
Mm,
and I don't really, so pretty much anything she's in, I kind of hate it.
Right.
You know? And it's probably not her fault, but I'm just like, oh gosh, I had the same reaction with Paul Reiser for years, but I also think that was because he was so good at being such an a-hole in Aliens, where I was just like, he was so easy to hate. I just hated him in everything. I hated him in Mad About You. I was just like, oh, so that's how good he was.
Yeah. You know who the person I have an aversion to, and who? It's people get shocked all the time. Tom Hanks.
Interesting. That is shocking. He's like America's like granddad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so curious.
Anything after Joe versus the Volcano.
Okay.
Pre Joe versus the Volcano, Tom Hanks, no aversion. After that, I the only movie I have ever wanted to ask for my money back that I went to see at the theater was Forrest Gump.
Oh, I mean that makes sense.
Yeah.
That movie is like propaganda and manipulation, like all rolled into one,
which right.
explains why my mom loves it so much.
It's funny because I'm going to use that because I've never been able to articulate to someone why that movie bothers me so much, but that's exactly it in like two words. So,
yeah, I mean, it's one of those, like if it's on cable and there's literally nothing else on, I might just leave it on because I like some of the other performances, but it's mm-hmm. it's a really terrible story where it's like, it's just awful. Persecutes the wrong people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I get it. That one isn't high on my list. I had to look to make sure Joe versus the Volcano came out after The Burbs though, which it did thankfully.
So. Oh yes. Yes.
So that's still safe because The Burbs is a big one in our house. And I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, The Burbs wasn't before Joe or after Joe, was it? Yeah. But I can see that. And he seems like a guy who has a really good sense of humor, but he doesn't do comedy anymore. And mm-hmm. I miss that.
And maybe that's what it is. Maybe I really enjoyed him as a comedic actor. And then when he stopped doing that, I was like, eh, I don't know. I don't know if that's it.
I get it. I get it though.
All right. How long would you last in a horror movie?
Oh boy. You know, I think I would probably make it to, I would at least make it through to the second half. It's like through the second act.
Okay. That's good.
That's pretty good. I don't know. I feel like I could probably be the final girl, but like, I think I'm just too good natured sometimes where like, I just feel like at some point that's going to be my downfall.
Mm.
I'm going to try to like empathize with the monster or something. And like, especially if it's like a creature monster, then I'm just going to want to like make friends with it.
Right.
And if it's like cookies. A serial killer, I'm just going to want to try to reason with it, which that never works either.
That's
so true. Yeah. So I think definitely second act, but I don't know if I'd make it the whole way. Plus, I hate running. So yeah. That would also be my downfall.
I was watching The Faculty today. I laughed so hard at the line where Elijah Wood's character says, "I think the only time somebody should run is when they're being chased." Exactly. And I was like, I agree with you 100%.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. That movie is fantastic. I love that. Like a lot of people sort of like kind of get like down on Robert Rodriguez a lot because of like, you know, his influences, and they sort of like call him like, you know, horror's Tarantino or whatever. Mm. But I don't know. There was like such a great run of movies that he had in the 90s that I'm like, honestly, I will always give him a chance, because I still just remember watching From Dusk Till Dawn and sitting in that theater and thinking that movie was going to be one thing, and it became something completely different.
Yes.
And that whole run that he had, like, I was just, I loved everything. Like, I was a huge fan of all of that. Like, even through like Sin City, you know, but I think The Faculty is easily, definitely, I would say like, oh gosh, I don't know, because I really love Desperado. But if we're talking genre, I would say it's definitely his second best, because I love From Dusk Till Dawn so damn much.
All right, well, let's talk about your book. So Monsters, Makeup and Effects, Volume 1. It comes out on October 20th, right? Correct?
It does, yes.
I have to tell you, so I'm about 25% through it. I wish
it's a lot, so I get
it. But it's so good.
Oh, thank you.
I'm really, really enjoying it. So I'm really looking forward to finishing it. But what inspired it? Like, what made you go, I'm going to write a book about makeup and special effects?
You know, I think for me, a lot of it came from years ago. I used to do this thing with, in conjunction with the Stan Winston School. Because as a kid, there was certain movies that really blew my mind. And Terminator was one of them, because I really thought robots could do these things. I mean, now they can, which is even scarier.
Yeah.
I mean, they could jump around and chase you and everything. So we're really close to Terminator days. But
isn't that scary?
It really kind of is when you put it into context. You're like, oh, we're almost there. Okay, that's not horrifying.
And just all the automation people have in their homes. Like, I remember when I was at work one day, and this was when like Google was starting to come out with like Nest and things like that. And they're like, yeah, Google Home, it's gonna like, it'll turn on your lights, it'll set your temperature. And I'm like, well, hello, Skynet. Unfortunately, nobody at work got that joke. And I was like, I need to leave and go work somewhere else. But, you know, whatever.
I get it. We don't have that stuff in our house, because I don't need AI listening to me while I'm just living my life and things like that. So I'm very much like, nope, I don't need Alexa. I don't need Nest. I don't need any of it. Mm-hmm. I could turn my own lights on. Thanks, everybody. Plus, I live in a really old apartment anyway, so it's not like our thermostat could get regulated anyway. So, well, you know, that's not going to happen in our house. But yeah, so I there was certain things that like I always felt really defined who I became as, just even as a movie fan, not even specifically horror. Because as a kid, like, we'd go see everything. But I remember Terminator was a really big one for me. Monster Squad was also another huge one for me. Predator, and then also Jurassic Park.
Yes.
And I remember thinking, like, you know, and this was like a few years after Stan had passed away, because he passed away when they were finishing up Terminator Salvation. And I just remember thinking, like, gosh, like, I know there's a book about Stan Winston, but I feel like, you know, let's bring it to the internet. And so I started doing these Stan Winston Week celebrations. And the second or third time that I did it, I started to really, like, I was just sort of at the beginning asking like really specific questions about certain effects. And then as the further I got into this and the more I was talking to people, I started to really ask them about Stan and about who he was as a person. And it became really an interesting process for me, because I realized that a lot of these artists, when they get contacted, you know, so many of them are just asked about like their work that they've done and that kind of thing, but nobody really talks to them about their lives and their experiences and what got them to where they're at. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe there's something to this. And I looked up and I was like, no, pretty much most of the makeup effects type books that are out there are pretty much similar to something like Tom Savini's Grand Illusions, which is just like, how do you create this and how do you make this? And I realized like, oh, you know, I think there could be something to this. And so back in 2016, so this has been a long journey for me. I set out, it's like, okay, if I can get 20 artists to talk to me, like, that's great. Mm-hmm. And so I set out with a few of the people I'd already worked with a few times, through the stuff I'd done with Stan Winston Week. And the first two people to agree to do it were Alec Gillis and Tom Woodruff Jr., who now run Studio ADI. And they've done, you know, everything from Tremors, which was sort of their first big project that they did, up through, Pennywise for the new It movies and things like that. And I was like, you know, I've talked to these guys before. If I could get them to say yes, that gives me some, you know, a little bit of a, you know, I can go to other people and say, oh, these guys are doing it. Would you want to do it? And so I just kind of started reaching out to people, and then it just kept snowballing because I realized the more and more I was talking to people, I'm like, oh, I should talk to this person. I should talk to that person. And it kept coming up in conversations too, where like, I have like, cause I always take notes in my email and I save them in my drafts folder. So I have like dozens of emails of names of artists that have come up during different conversations where somebody will be like, oh, you should really talk to this person, or you really need to interview this person. And so I decided, I was like, you know, okay, I did the first 20, and there was a book that came out in 2017, called Monster Squad. But I still had a lot more interviews, and I was kind of like, okay, what do I do now? Like, do I just call it, or do I keep going with this? And I just kind of realized, I was like, I really want to keep going. And so I just kept talking to more and more people. And in the meantime, I wasn't really happy with that first publisher, just because there was a lot of miscommunication. Basically, the book came out and I didn't even know it.
Oh,
which was a huge bummer. Yeah. I remember I was back home, visiting. It was like in November of 2017. And I was like, oh, you know, I knew the book was coming up soon. I should just, take a look to see if it's up for pre-order on Amazon. That way I can like start pushing it and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I went to Amazon and it was there. And I was like, oh, okay. Uh-oh. Yeah. And so that threw me off, and I didn't really get to push that book the way I wanted to.
Right.
I mean, I'm still really proud of it. And all of the interviews that are in that first book are actually going to be throughout this series as well, because I was able to get the rights back to those interviews.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That's, and then, so from there, I kind of was like, well, what am I going to do with this now? Because I don't want to go back there. I don't want to self-publish. And for a while, it was actually going to be coming, the series was going to be coming out through Fangoria. But then they sort of reconfigured themselves after last year. And I was like, okay, you know, while I'm happy, ultimately, I'm also like, okay, what am I going to do with all this? Because at this point, as of last year, I had like almost 80 interviews like collected.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, what am I, like, did I do all of this for nothing? What's going to happen? And I ended up getting connected with Michael over at AM Inc. And actually, I got connected to him through the assistant of Robert Kurtzman. And she was like, you should talk to him. He's doing a lot of books with these types of artists. You know, I think you guys would get along really well. And it's been amazing being over there. So I'm part of their label that's called Dark Ink, which is more of the horror type stuff.
Right.
And it's like, it's such a different experience. Like, I have somebody who's like supportive, who's been really helping to push the book to really be the support system I didn't have the first time.
Yeah.
Which has been amazing. And then what's even been cooler about the whole situation is that because of this, like, it's actually brought about other projects where I'm actually in the process of working on a book for a completely different arena than this. And then also, he just asked me to, work with, sort of a notable name in the horror industry to work on their biography as well.
Ooh, I look forward to hearing more about that.
Thank you. Yeah. So the one project will probably get announced like by the end of the year, the biography, probably sometime next year, but it's like, I'm like, oh, so now I have to like come up with 6 books in like the next 2 to 3 years. I can do this, right? Sure. But yeah, so it's been a really amazing journey. And honestly, like, it's cool for me to be able to do this and be like, hey, look what I've created. But the real thrill for me is being able to allow fans to get to know these people that helped us all fall in love with the genre.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Because I just think that, like, you know, directors are important and actors mm-hmm. are important and writers are important. But those creators that are creating these monsters and villains and characters and things like that, like, they deserve a little bit of the moment in the spotlight as well.
Absolutely. That's one thing that really struck me when I was reading the book is I kind of went through and looked at, I didn't read ahead, but I looked at who was featured in the book. And then I looked at, you know, kind of the key movies that they had been involved with or TV shows just to kind of see, you know, like what was to come. And there were people that I had never heard of. There's a couple that I've heard of, but a lot of them I'd never heard of, but they have been instrumental in making some of my favorite movies. And I was like, that's terrible that I haven't heard of these people because I haven't paid enough attention to the credits. Or now on Netflix, it does, you have to physically choose to watch the credits, right? Like,
yes, it's so annoying.
They deserve their moment in the spotlight for sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when I initially started out doing this, my intention was really to talk to the people that really hadn't been talked to before. You know, I didn't necessarily want to go after like the Rick Bakers and the Tom Savinis because I wanted, you know, as much as I love Rick Baker and as much as, you know, American Werewolf pretty much set the bar
yes.
for modern special effects, there was like 30 or 40 other people on that crew mm-hmm. who never really have gotten to talk about it that much. So initially it was like kind of mixing like sort of names that might sound familiar to some people, but, you know, maybe a lot of people hadn't heard of. And then my goal was by the end that they would come out fans of these people mm-hmm. because I know I am. And that was ultimately, you know, just sort of something I wanted to do was just give people who didn't always normally typically get the interview requests and get to walk the red carpet and things like that, the chance yeah. to really tell their stories. And admittedly now, as I've kind of fleshed it out a little bit, there are a few bigger names that kind of come up through here. Like V. Neal is one of them because I grew up loving her and thinking she was the coolest.
Yeah.
I still do. Even though I've talked to her and she's in the book, I'm still incredibly intimidated by her. She's so cool. And I was like, I will never be this cool, you know? And then we've got, you know, Oscar winners and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, but I also wanted to like give, you know, cause we have like Tom Berman who, you know, he's been working in the effects industry since the Planet of the Apes days. And we've got somebody like Howard Berger, who of course works for K&B, which is like probably the most well-known special effects house now because of Walking Dead mm-hmm. and things like that. And the different awards that they've won over the years and everything, you know, but then I also wanted to talk to, you know, folks like Matt Rose, who unfortunately is no longer here, but, you know, he was really one of the creative forces behind, you know, the Predator from the original movie and mm-hmm. the Creature from Monster Squad and Hellboy from Guillermo del Toro's movies and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was trying to fight the right balance. And it was something I've been struggling to do as I like kind of figure out who's going to go in each book of just making sure I give a really good blend of right. different experiences, because even though there's 80 people and a lot of, I'd say like 70% of them came to this world because they grew up loving horror movies too. Nobody had the same experiences, which was kind of amazing because I was worried about repetition and things mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah. They're all very different.
Yeah. And I was really grateful for that. Cause also, another part of it was like, I just didn't want to end up with like a book series about 80 different white guys either. And no offense, but like, you know, I wanted women. I wanted artists from around the world. I wanted artists from different backgrounds and things like that. So I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just like sort of this homogenized, mm-hmm. Capturing of like what happened in the industry, you know, throughout sort of the heyday of special effects.
It's interesting when you mentioned like not wanting it to be all white guys, like I reading the V. Neal section, just her talking about how it was something she was always interested in, but then she's like, well, that's kind of a man's world. So I didn't think it was ever something I was going to get to be a part of. That's kind of an eye opener, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think her story is really interesting too, because she also sort of kind of came from this like fashion background as well. Mm-hmm. And I also really loved just hearing her stories with Joel Schumacher, because I didn't even realize it until I started doing a project for Phantom of the Opera 2004, but I didn't realize that he'd come from costuming as well.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't really talk about that too much. She just, you know, talked about how they really got along very well. And, you know, he had a very fabulous sort of sense of style and flair and things like that. But it was interesting because, like, it just proves that, like, you can do different things in this industry. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have to just be one thing, which was another thing that I did when I set out to do these interviews. I wanted to look at, you know, guys who maybe originally came from, like, different aspects, like somebody like Phil Tippett was doing like stop motion creatures. And then he went into special effects for a while and then kind of went into visual effects because of everything that happened during Jurassic Park. And these days now he's back to sort of doing a lot of stop motion stuff because he just finally finished his passion project, which is called Mad God, that he's been working on since RoboCop, I want to say.
Wow.
Yeah. It's making the festival run right now, but I'm pretty sure it should be out, I think, by early next year.
Oh, excellent.
For once it finishes its festival run. So I wanted to kind of like get folks like that or somebody like Everett Burrell, who now works typically just in visual effects, because, you know, that to me was kind of interesting. Cause I think also visual effects become sort of an easy scapegoat for a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I get it. Like visual effects, if they're bad, they can really take you out of a movie. But I've always wondered, like, well, why do we give bad special effects a pass? The bad visual effects were like, no, this is wrong. And this is, you know, this is an abomination. So I just think, and I think there's a sort of creative process to that work that mirrors a lot of what happens in special makeup effects and things like that. So, you know, it was just trying to really find people that were kind of coming edit from different walks, like people who've gone on to do directing and things like that. You know, people who've had their own shops that maybe don't have them anymore. Some people who've retired altogether from the industry.
Right.
But yeah, it's kind of amazing. I think that the biggest takeaway that I had from this whole process over the years was that I don't feel like the limitations that I used to have for myself in terms of what I thought I could and couldn't do, I don't think those exist anymore because I'm talking to all these different folks who, you know, some of them come from the most unlikely of scenarios to make it to Hollywood, did it. And if they can do it, you know, why can't any of us, you know, mm-hmm. go out and do whatever it is that we're passionate about or we have a dream about or something, you know, something that we want to pursue. For me, it just showed me that, like, you know, there are the only barriers are the ones that I'm putting up for myself.
Right. And that's a great takeaway. And I think one of the things that I found, like, it was kind of a common thread through the interviews that I read was just their tenacity and how they were like, they would say things like, you know, I think it's Tony Gardner says something about how we'd figure it out, we'd make it work no matter how we had to do it. But just that tenacity, but doing what they wanted to do, getting something done, you know, that was kind of throughout the ones that I've read so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also too, what's the kind of the coolest thing about being in this world is that ultimately it's all magic tricks. And that was something I kind of learned as I talked to more and more people. And then eventually sort of talking to Tom Savini, who was sort of the king of the quote unquote magic trick back in the late 70s, early 80s, because he was doing things back then that nobody really had attempted.
Right.
Like, you know, you had beautiful makeups coming out of like out of the work of somebody like Dick Smith, but it was like Tom Savini who was like, we're going to put, you know, an arrow through Kevin Bacon's throat.
That's exactly what I just thought of.
Right. And it's still one of these things that, like, it's a moment in film history that still gets mimicked to this day,
mm-hmm.
because it was a really cool magic trick that somebody was able to pull off. And now somebody out there wants to do the same magic trick.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think there's something kind of inherently cool about that, where, like, you're given something impossible to achieve. And now you have to figure out the way to make it happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing is, it's like, sure, it's great to have tons of resources and money and all kinds of stuff. But, like, you know, a lot of these guys, like, there's quite a few people, like, throughout this series who came up through, like, Troma and Full Moon and Empire. And none of those movies had budgets. I mean, there's some people who didn't even get paid from those movies.
Right.
But they, you know, they were given $40 and said, go make a monster. Mm-hmm. How do you make a monster with $40? Well, let's figure it out. And they did it, you know? And so I think if, you know, the one thing I wanted to do too, is like, this is definitely meant for people who love horror movies, who love monsters, who love that kind of stuff. But I also wanted this to be something where even if you like, if you're just interested in like the movie making process in general, that like you could walk away from this feeling inspired that like anything is possible, whether it's something you want to create on the screen, something you want to do in your life, like, you know, you can go out there and do it. It's going to seem impossible and it's going to be challenging and you're going to have to, you know, put a lot of things on the line. But if you can do this and you can pull it off, like you're going to reap some pretty incredible rewards.
That's awesome. Was there anything that surprised you in any of the conversations that you had?
You know, yes. Some of it, I it's not in the book because a lot of times I'd be in these conversations and they would get really personal. And then you sort of learn the dynamics of the industry through the 80s and the 90s, where you kind of were starting to hear about like who didn't quite gel with who and things like that. So sometimes I was surprised at how candid people would be. Mm. But I think ultimately most of that stuff isn't in the books because it really wasn't the focus of it. I think people were just sort of venting a little bit or just, you know, giving me some context and things like that. So I think that was a big surprise to me. I think the biggest sort of eye-opening interview that I had was with David Lee Roy Anderson, who is, ironically enough, the husband of Heather Langenkamp. And I don't know if many people know this, but most of these days, Heather works at their shop. And so she's kind of in this world now, which is sort of cool. Mm-hmm. Part of it was like, I wanted to talk to him because one, he's a fantastic artist. Two, he's a second generation artist because his dad also came through the industry.
Right.
And then also because I always was really fascinated by how his life was sort of mimicked in New Nightmare. Mm-hmm. And I was just always kind of like floored by it. And talking to him, it was really eye-opening in a lot of ways because one, I don't think there's any who doesn't recognize that like horror actresses a lot of times have to deal with some pretty not so awesome fans. Right. And so some lines can get crossed and things like that. But I didn't realize just how on the nose a lot of the story of New Nightmare was in comparison to what was actually happening in David and Heather's lives. And like, I remember one of the stories he was telling me was like, Heather had a very aggressive stalker. I think it was around the time of like Alien 3, I think is when it was. And it was just a lot to deal with. And they got a call where David was asked to come and work in London for Alien 3. And like, you know what? Now is the best time to get out of the country. Let's just go and do this.
Right.
And so I didn't realize like how close to home that was. And so, you know, just hearing the process of them having to like talk to Wes Craven about it, figure out what lines could be crossed, what lines shouldn't be crossed. And, mm-hmm. you know, and ultimately Wes gave them like final say in terms of like what they were okay with putting into the movie and what they really didn't want to put in. And so that was a really fascinating aspect of that interview. And then it took this turn that I wasn't emotionally prepared for. And I know David wasn't either, but what's kind of incredible to me is like, I didn't even realize that this was happening. Because at the time all of this was happening, Heather was doing conventions and appearances and everything seemed okay. But their son, it was around the time of Star Trek. So it had been like around 2008, 2009, their son Atticus was overseas for school and ended up getting sick. And They weren't sure what it was. And it ended up being a brain tumor. And that basically threw everything, like their total and complete lives, like into chaos, obviously. And I did David's interview in two parts and we started to talk about it. And he's like, you know, I need to go. I have to go take care of some stuff. And I didn't realize that when I was talking to him, it was kind of coming up on the anniversary of Atticus' death, and which was right around Christmas. And so it was really hard for them. And I didn't know that I was coming into that and I didn't, which is okay. Like I wanted him to be able to feel like he could share with me, but I also didn't want to cross any lines he wasn't comfortable with. So it took a few weeks for us to kind of come back together to talk about the second part of the interview. And honestly, like, I think I we talked for about 90 minutes that day. And I think I probably cried for about 60 minutes of that 90 minutes on mute. Cause I was just like, as David was talking and just discussing all these things that they went through as a family and ultimately still having to say goodbye to Atticus, was just so heartbreaking. And then I just, it made me realize like the strength that it took, because while all this was going on, I don't think Heather publicly was talking about the fact that her son was at home sick when she was doing conventions and things like that, but they needed to make money because they had to slow things down at the shop in order to take care of him. David basically started doing TV gigs because movies would take him out of town and he couldn't do that. And it was just, and it was interesting to me that what started out as a celebration of David's career ended up becoming sort of a tribute to their son by the end. And that to me was like one of the most genuinely surprising and affecting moments of this whole entire journey, because it just sort of put into perspective what I was doing in a way.
Right.
Like it wasn't just me putting words on a page anymore. Like this was somebody talking about their child that they lost. And I just, it hit me really hard. And that was like, that was probably one of the chapters that I, you know, and I worked hard on all of them, but I think I worked exceptionally hard on that one because I wanted to make sure that I did right by them, because I know it took a lot for David to talk about things that he did in that chapter. And I didn't want it to be for naught.
Right.
So that to me was like a really incredible experience for me personally, not even professionally, just personally, that he put that trust into me. And then I remember the email that he sent me, because I, throughout this whole process, I always let everybody see their chapters and give notes and things like that. And I actually sent it to him, and I didn't even mean to, but I sent it to him on Father's Day last year. And he emailed me back, and it was a really nice email. But the one thing he said to me was that, you know, this was the greatest Father's Day gift anybody could have given me. And like, that was it. I was like sobbing when I read that email. And I just, it made me realize like, again, you know, none of this is like curing cancer or anything like that. Like I'm not doing anything that's going to save somebody's life, but to preserve somebody's memories like this, like I know it matters in some ways. It may not matter in the big universe ways, but in sort of the macrocosm ways, I think it really does, you know?
And I mean, I wouldn't sell that short either. There could be people that read that and be like, you know what, this is some, maybe they've gone through something similar and it's going to give them some kind of strength to read someone else's experience like that. So,
yeah.
And that's Lance Anderson is like his father, right? David's father, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, because I think he mentions it too. And he says something about Atticus working in the shop as well at times.
Yeah, and it was like, I remember him talking about Atticus, but he hadn't really talked about losing Atticus.
Right.
And so I interviewed David like a few weeks after. That's why I was kind of shocked. But I maybe Lance was just not at a point where he was like really wanting to talk about it, or he realized it wasn't necessarily his story to share specifically, but I just, cause I remember like him talking about that, you know, and then it was like, I got to David and I was like, oh my gosh, like this is heavy, you know, in a good way, but it is heavy, you know? And then it was like the pressure on me to just make sure, like, I can't screw this up.
Right.
You know, I can't screw this up for David. I can't screw this up for the legacy of his family. I can't screw this up for Atticus's memories. You know, I have to get this right. So if nothing else out of any of this, out of these 80 plus interviews, if I've nailed this one, I'm happy. Everything else is gravy at that point.
Well, it sounds like you did based on his email back to you. So
as long as David's happy, then I'm happy. So
absolutely. And that's the other thing. Like, it does seem like I saw a lot of, you know, references to family and how important family was in these interviews. And there's a couple people that, you know, are related, David and Lance. And then there's, I think, a married couple.
Tom and Barry Berman. Yes.
So that's kind of neat that it's kind of a family business for some people.
Yeah. And there's a little bit more of that too, as we will go on too, because I, you know, one of the interviews I have is with the Kyoto brothers. Oh, cool. You know, who did Killer Clowns from Outer Space, yeah, and things like that. And the Ernest, I think it's Ernest Scared Stupid and stuff like that, which I love.
Me too.
It's such a fun movie every October.
It is.
And it's interesting because even if there's these little subsets of like people that are related or people that are married, what is ultimately interesting is that after all of these years, you know, even though there was a lot of rivalries back in the heyday, and there's probably still a little bit of a rivalry these days, ultimately everybody is a family. And I've seen that reflected a lot.
Right.
Especially as we've lost a few artists over the years, mm-hmm, where I've seen people who are like, you know, I didn't maybe always get along with this person, but ultimately, like, you know, they were incredible. They did so, you know, it's just being able to sort of be like, yeah, you know, we gave each other the business back in the day, but, you know, I miss them because they were my friend, you know? And right. I think ultimately, like, for his, you know, like in any industry, there's always going to be the bad stuff that comes along. But I think ultimately, like, there's this camaraderie between everybody where even if they don't see eye to eye, even if they're coming at, you know, the work that they're doing from different places, like ultimately everybody supports everybody, you know, despite, you know, a few speed bumps here and there. You know, cause like I actually had in the process of this, I had two artists who I won't mention their names, but literally hated each other and had not spoken to each other in decades. And they were both in the first book. And they realized that they both had just so miscommunicated with each other through the years that they just realized like they'd fought over really nothing. And I don't know necessarily, I would say the book was like the reason, but I think it was a catalyst. I think it was something that made them both realize like, oh, I think we're being a little silly here. It's been 30 years and they're friendly now.
That's brilliant.
And I just was like, that's really cool. Like I was able to sort of mend a fence and I don't know that it'll happen again, but it was just really cool to kind of see like, oh, okay. Because it was just like, they both worked in the same shop for years and years and years. And they both ended up talking about each other in sort of offhanded ways. And they realized that like, there really was no rivalry. They were just kind of just caught up in this moment that didn't even exist.
Right.
Which was kind of crazy. But I think all of us do that in some way, shape, or form, you know? So I think there's a good lesson there that like, you know, if there's somebody out there that maybe you need to smooth things over with, like one conversation can change a lot.
Yes.
If you're willing to listen.
All right. So this is volume one. There's going to be three more volumes. Is that correct?
That is correct. So, yes.
Awesome.
So,
excellent.
Yeah. So volume two will be coming out probably, I want to say like early spring next year. I want to give this about like 6 months or so to kind of be out there in the world and then unleash the other one. But the manuscript's already done, which is good. A little less pressure on me for now, you know, which is just like, oh, but then I got to do three and four still. Okay. but yeah, so what I did is when I did get the rights back to the first book that I'd done, I wanted to be able to include those 20 interviews. So each book has 5 of the interviews from that original book in it.
Oh, perfect.
And then 15 new. And then ultimately, I think volume 3 and 4 might end up also going over 20 interviews. Nice. I just have to figure out the pages because I don't want to put an 800-page book out. Nobody's going to read it then. I mean, putting out a 500-page book was pretty crazy. Like my publisher came back to me with the manuscript and he's like, it's 500 pages. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? Like, cause I think the other version, the first one was like 300 and something. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And I know in this book, especially you mentioned Tony Gardner, his chapter is probably the longest out of everybody's, but he was so generous with his time. I think we had like maybe we probably talked for a total of like 5 hours. And he just like went into everything. And so if anybody's willing to talk with me that much, I'm going to listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to get all that good stuff in there.
like his ET story. I love his story about sneaking onto the Universal lot.
Right? Like I couldn't even imagine trying to pull that off today.
No.
It's trying brilliant. To just go meet Spielberg. Like I'm just gonna go try to find Spielberg. That's what I'm gonna do. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's a normal thing to do.
So good. That's the tenacity that I was talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tony's one of my favorite people. I love what he's been able to do with like the Child's Play series or the Chucky series, as we call it now, since we've pivoted from the words Child's Play to Chucky.
Yes.
But yeah, I love what he's been able to do with those. And I love the fact that like he's one of the very few artists that's ever been able to kill himself on screen.
That's right. Yeah. That's awesome.
So yeah. And he's just a really fantastic guy. And has done a lot of really great work. And he was just a real pleasure. Honestly, everybody was. I could tell this story because I think he's in volume 2 or 3, and it's fine because he knows. But one of my sort of more interesting interviews ended up being Steve Johnson, who's a guy who came up like doing like Ghostbusters and Fright Night. He was part of Rick Baker's crew back in the day. So he was there for Videodrome and American Werewolf and things like that. And like, I adore Steve. But Steve has a very prickly personality and he knows it. And he sort of plays it up too. Like he's kind of like the lovable jerk of the industry. But he recognizes that. And I remember because like I'd interviewed him previously just because I'd done for its 30th anniversary, I did a whole magazine dedicated to Fright Night. And I was like, oh, I'll see if Steve wants to talk. And he did. And so we talked and stuff. And so when I did this, you know, I approached him and he's like, yeah, you know, I've got my books coming up, but we can do this too. And I was like, that's great. We can like sort of cross promote. Totally great. And so the day that I had my interview with him, and it was super early in the morning and it was like a weekend. I was still in my PJs because it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm not getting dressed to do an interview on Skype. I'm just not. And so we get on there and Steve has his video camera on and he's like, oh, you're not turning your video on? And I was like, Steve, it's like, it's 9 in the morning. I'm still drinking coffee and trying to wake myself up. No, and he's like, oh, fine. If that's how we're going to do it. Okay. I was like, oh gosh. I was like, trust me, you're not missing anything anyway. You don't need this. And so then we get all reset up. And then he was like, okay. He's like, so I quit smoking cigarettes today. I hate everything. How are we going to do this interview where I'm not going to want to kill myself by the end? Because everybody asks me the same stuff all the time. And I was like, oh, okay. So it's going to be one of these situations. Interesting.
Oh no.
And I was really intimidated because I was like, oh my God, how am I going to pivot this?
Right.
And make it so he's actually engages with the questions I'm asking. And it really like, I don't even know how, but it worked out. And by the end of it, he was like, you know, he's like, this is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. And he was like, he was like, I was ready to just hang up 2 hours ago. And he's like, but I really appreciate you sort of bearing with me. And it's funny because like I usually go back home to Chicago every August to co-host a convention there. And a few years ago, they had a big Fright Nights celebration and Steve was there. So I did his panel and like we just hung out like all weekend, like we were best friends. And it was just really funny
because
like this guy who was just so like, and then he's like the big softy at heart, you know. And I think he's just sort of a little misinterpreted by a lot of folks. But yeah, it's like I've been in this industry as a whole for 14 years, but I think the last 5.5 years have really made me so much better at what I do only because I really had to challenge myself in a lot of ways.
Right.
Like there's only so much of a challenge you get out of having a 4-minute conversation in a junket, you know,
yeah, that's fair. Whereas,
you know, you have to have a 2.5-hour conversation with somebody who's like not really into it. Like, all right, if you can make them into it by the end of it, then you've won.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome. That's fantastic. All right. Well, are you ready to share your 5 essential Halloween movies with us?
Yes. I'm so curious because I know I threw some curveballs at you.
You did. But you said you wanted to pick some things that, you know, wouldn't be, typical go-tos. So I like it though. Talk to me about House 2, the second story.
So whenever, like I love both House and House 2. But I think for me, I always have sort of appreciated House 2 more because it is so good natured. It is a really, it really leans more into the comedy than the original House does. And I just, I absolutely adore how much it sort of blends horror and fantasy and sort of this good natured story about families and legacy and things like that. Like, I just, I love it so much. And it has a catter puppy in it.
Oh my gosh.
Who doesn't love the catter puppy?
Bippy.
Oh my gosh. Like, I don't know why we don't have, somebody does not have a figure of that exist. Like, I want it. Like, give it to me, NECA. Somebody, I mean, that's too obscure for NECA, but somebody out there needs to make them. But it was one of those, like, I think I saw it before. I saw the first one as a kid. And I think the reason that I originally rented it was because it had Jonathan Stark from Fright Night in it. And I was a huge fan of Fright Night as a kid. I still am. Mm-hmm. But when I saw that he was in it, I was like, oh, what is this movie? And then I just totally fell in love with it. Like, I love Ari Gross in it. I think his sort of bumbling comedy works really well with it. I think him and Jonathan Stark together are just fantastic. Sort of one of my favorite like friendships in 80s horror, you know, and there's a lot of good ones out there. I also really love Royal Dano, who plays Gramps in it.
Yeah. The chemistry between Charlie and Gramps and Jesse, like, it's unbelievable. Like, it just grounds the movie despite its bonkers plot.
Oh, I know. Right. And I think too, it's like, as a kid, like, I would watch Westerns with my grandpa. So I think for me that they had like a grandpa character that was representing sort of this, you know, in the 80s, sort of a bygone era of movies. We were getting a little bit of Westerns in the 80s, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it like tied together like these memories of sitting with my grandpa, watching old Westerns, but yet it was in the context of a horror movie, which I love. And yeah, it's so much fun. It has a Halloween party in it.
Yeah.
Which again, like, if a movie has like Halloween as a theme to it, yes, that's an October movie for me for sure.
Agreed.
And I love the fact that, you know, I love the supporting cast because we have Laura Park Lincoln in it as well. Amy Yazbeck, who is hilarious as well in it. I can even tolerate Bill Maher in it, which is says a lot. And I love the fact that they sort of did this thing where, like, in the first one, we have Norm from George Wendt. And then this one brings in John Ratzenberger. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally blanking because I don't have my card in front of me. Oh, so John Ratzenberger, when he comes in, it says like electrician and adventurer or something like that on his business card. So when I joined Daily Dead, that was sort of a joke that I put on my business card. So it's my business card for Daily Dead reads managing editor and adventurer. And everybody always asks me about it. And I'm like, it's my tribute to Halloween or to House 2.
Amazing. I like when the Aztec princess or Mayan princess like smells the business card.
Yeah. She's like, what is this? Yes. And so it's just so much fun. And there's like, you get a little Kane Hodder appearance in there as well.
Yeah.
Cause he shows up during the Halloween party, but it's just, it's something that really, again, I wanted my imagination pushed as a kid and this really did it because it gives you so many different things because like each door is like this portal to a new world. And sometimes you have like, you know, baby pterodactyls and sometimes you have evil cowboys and, you know, sometimes you get catter puppies. Like you just never know. And I think to me, that's what makes it so, so much fun. And like I said, I like the first house a lot.
It's definitely a lot darker with like the Vietnam themes. So yeah.
And you know, the death of a child.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things hanging over that one and it's great. But for me, like if I'm just going to go and have fun, like House 2 is it for me.
Mm-hmm. All right. The Lords of Salem.
Yes. So I know this was a new one for you. So I'm curious what your reaction was.
Well, I've said many times before that I'm not a huge fan of Rob Zombie movies. But then when I started thinking about it, I realized I've actually only seen his Halloween movies. So, you know, 2 out of 7 isn't really a fair representation, I guess. And I actually really enjoyed The Lords of Salem. I think pretty much anything with witches, I'm there for. Like that's one of my go-tos are books or movies about witches. So, but Sherry Moon Zombie is so good in it.
Right?
she's got kind of this understated thing going on.
There's like this real sadness to her performance, like this woman. And that to me, what makes it so effective is like, there's just this inherent sadness to everything that's happening to her character mm-hmm. in this film, because it's just her fate. There's nothing that she or anyone else is going to do that's going to save her from this. Like, it's just going to happen regardless. Mm-hmm. And that to me, like when everybody talks about like how, you know, cause I get Rob Zombie sort of comes with this baggage of like, well, he's like a rocker guy. So he's just into like the aesthetics, and there's really, you know, nothing deep to his movies. And I think there's a few movies you could definitely say that for, mm-hmm. but I think in terms of like Lords of Salem or even The Devil's Rejects, I think those to me are like the movies where he really gets into psychology of characters in a way that I don't feel like he gets respected for enough. Mm-hmm. But to me, Lords of Salem is always an October watch. That score, like, you just kind of feel it in your gut. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's so oppressive and it's so haunting. Like, I just, every time I watch that movie, I'm sort of in a stunned silence by the end.
Right.
So I just kind of sit there for a few minutes. I'm just like, whew, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like it's also very, for him, it's very restrained for the most part until kind of the end. Like, there are like bits and pieces, like, you know, at the beginning or throughout that aren't, but overall it's a very, you don't get a lot of, well, we'll talk about House of a Thousand Corpses shortly, but you don't get a lot of that kind of like riotous violence that you necessarily get in Halloween or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was very surprised by how much I enjoyed it. And I'm like, I'm going to watch this again this month.
And it's really like a celebration of like female empowerment. Because like Meg Foster in that movie is like so freaking fearless and so mm-hmm. good. And I love Patricia Quinn and Dee Wallace.
Yes.
And like, they're the best old, like little old biddies, like living in a building, but they're really up to no good. Like mm-hmm. I love them so much. And I have to also say too, like I, every time I watch that movie, Jeff Daniel Phillips re-breaks my heart. Like I think he's an actor. Like, I know because he works within Rob Zombie movies. So he's kind of seen under this sort of gaze, but I feel like he is an actor that does not get appreciated enough, because he's really, really good. And I'd love to see him break out and get like, I want him to get that role, you know, like back in the day, like a Tarantino type role.
Right.
Where people would understand just how darn good he is. Because you see it in Lords of Salem. And I don't think we've been able to see him pushed like that since.
Yeah. Thank you for introducing me to that. Yeah. No, I really enjoyed it.
I'm so glad.
We'll definitely watch it again.
Oh, good, good. That makes me happy. Like, I love being able to like share things with people that, you know, hopefully it works for them, you know, and then they get to, you know, they fall in love with a new favorite.
Yeah. I think this could be an October watch for me going forward. Yeah. Creepshow.
Oh yes. I love Creepshow. And of course, I mean, the TV series is fun, but I am talking about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one of those movies as a kid I discovered pretty early on. And it was one of those, like, I didn't know much about like what anthologies were. So it just was just like a really cool collection of stories to me. And it gave you, mm-hmm. it's one of those that gives you a little something of everything, but it also has Halloween vibes to it because mm-hmm. of the wraparound and stuff. And I was somebody who very much grew up absolutely loving Stephen King.
Yeah.
Like, I remember one of the first novels I snuck out of my mom's room when I was a kid was actually Christine.
Oh, okay.
And because it was just right around the time that I saw the movie and I was like, oh, I want to read the book. And so I would sneak her Stephen King books, like when I knew she wasn't in the back. And then I would like try to like, put a little ear, like dog ear them and then slip it back in her bedroom before she went to bed at night, so she wouldn't notice it was missing and stuff. So that was kind of like what that was kind of like my way of like getting into Stephen King.
Right.
So when I discovered this movie, I was like, oh my gosh. And that artwork just totally captivated me as a kid. And I was like, oh, what is this creep on the cover? And he wants me to watch his movie. And it's one of those things that has a lot of like really adult themes, but yet there's a lot about it that I really just, I loved as a kid. Like, you know, even something like the section of the Something to Tide You Over that's dealing with some very adult themes. Like, mm-hmm. I was just mesmerized by that as a kid.
Yeah.
And also it was really surprising to me because I kind of grew up just knowing Leslie Nielsen as a funny guy.
Absolutely. Yes.
And even Ted Danson. And mm-hmm. so to see them doing sort of something very dramatic was a real eye opener to me as a kid. But it just, it's one of those movies that just has something for everybody. But I will say, as I've gotten older and as I've moved out to LA where you just can't escape them, I have a real problem watching the Creeping Up on You segment. Oh. I am such a chicken when it comes to cockroaches because mm-hmm. I never really grew up around them. Like, it just wasn't part of it. Like, my aunt lived in like the city of Chicago, so she had them, but like where I grew up, they just didn't exist.
Right.
And they freak me out. Like,
yeah,
they probably freak me out worse than spiders. And
100%. Yeah. For me,
especially now. Cause like some of them fly and I was just like, no, we don't do this. What are we doing? Like spiders can't fly. Mm-hmm. So for me, like just, it's funny. Like as a kid, I used to watch it all the time. And now as an adult, I'm like, I'll just skip this one. Cause it's like living out like my everyday life. Like last night we were at like a movie for Beyond Fest and we're standing outside. I went to go sit down and my other half of you was like, oh, there's a roach right there. Oh, there's a roach. Right. And like, we're like, you know, in a nice area, like just sitting in like a pavilion.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's so LA. Yeah.
That's the first time. So I similar did not grow up with cockroaches. And I remember I was probably I was old enough to drink. And so I'm in Canada. But I was old enough to drink in the States because we'd gone to New Orleans and I remember getting drinks. So I was at least 21 and we were walking down the street and I crunched on something and I was like, what was that? And I looked down and it was a cockroach because they were falling from the trees.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, nope. I'm done. So yeah, that's one of my favorite segments in it. However, it is also the hardest one for me to watch.
Like I get through about like two thirds of it. And I was like, okay, maybe we're done.
Yeah.
I always try to see how far I could push myself. Each time. I'm like, but it's so funny because like as a kid, it didn't never bothered me. As an adult, I'm like, oh no, thank you.
So what is your favorite segment in Creepshow?
You know, it really is a tie between Something to Tide You Over and The Crate. Because they're both such different experiences. Like the Jordy Verrill one is fun and goofy. And of course, it's Stephen King. And it's got some really great visuals in it and things like that. Father's Day, of course, is a classic because you got Ed Harris doing his really weird dance in it.
His dancing.
I asked him about it once at a junket and he was laughing because he'd like earlier that year, his kids had finally seen that show. And they were so embarrassed by his dancing. And I just thought that was like hilarious. And he's like, honestly, I don't even know what I was doing there. He was just like, move around and dance. And so that's what I did. But yeah, I think Something to Tide You Over really is like, in terms of the storytelling, like the pinnacle. And then if you want to go with like sort of the dark comedy that's really brutal, The Crate is like where it's at because it's just so in your face. And again, it's such a different role for Adrienne Barbeau. Like you could just hear her screaming in your ear. Like the minute you mention that story, if you're a horror fan, like you hear, you know, Billy screaming like Henry, and then it just stuck in your ear forever.
Yeah. All right. House of 1,000 Corpses.
Yes. And it's funny because I know you mentioned we were going to get into these more, but it's funny because the first time I saw this movie, I absolutely hated it. And it was like such a weird experience because it was myself and my ex. And then we had like my cousin would come along and would come to our movies and stuff. And then they had a friend that would come with. And I don't know what happened, but their friend, and she was my friend too, Julie, she had such a visceral reaction to the movie. She had to leave. Because she ended up having a panic attack during the movie and actually ended up like going on anxiety meds from there on out because I don't know what it triggered, but she was about halfway through and she just was like, I gotta go. And I think because it was so much And, you know, and it is a lot rougher. Like you can see, if you watch this movie and watch Lords of Salem, there's an obvious progression of Zombie as a filmmaker between those two movies. There's a huge progression. And, but I remember like after it was done, like we left the theater and I was like, that was terrible. But then I was like, and I remember it was like the next Halloween, because I don't think it was out that, I think it was like 2004 Halloween. And I was like, oh, maybe we should rent that again, you know, because it was weird because we were kind of distracted because of everything going on. So I was like, let's just try it again. And I rented it and I was like, oh, that was so much more fun than I remember it being. And it's, of course, it is Rob Zombie doing Texas Chainsaw 2. You know, I'm fine with that because I mean, like, I think for me, because I was somebody who grew like would go to White Zombie shows knowing that I was going to get a horror show with them.
Right.
And I knew that that was what he does. It's like he always celebrates the things that he loves about the genre through whether it's music or movies. Like I was okay with it. You know, some people are a little less okay with it. And I wouldn't even call House of a Thousand Corpses like anywhere. You know, it's in the top five. Not that there's only like seven movies Rob Zombie's done, but like it's definitely not his best movie. But for me, you know, especially in October when I'm looking for like sort of a weird retro-y Halloween vibe, like it's a movie that I go back to a lot because, you know, it takes place on Halloween. I love stories about, you know, sort of haughty, like, you know, people who think they know, you know, they know better than everybody else going into circumstances that they are so ill prepared to deal with. And there's some genuinely disturbing sequences in that movie.
Oh yeah.
That still stick with me, but it's definitely, it took a while for it to grow on me, but I do love it. I'm curious. Was it a lot?
It was a lot. It was a lot. And I'm still not quite sure what to make of it. So it'll definitely warrant a rewatch. However, I did really love the style of it. Like I get what you're saying when you're like, if you want something kind of a throwback that feels like, you know, like a retro horror movie, it does have a kind of grimy grindhouse feel to it. I could see it being like a lot of fun if you went to the drive-in to see it and like just had that kind of experience. But like, I'll never look at Dwight from The Office the same way again.
Right. Because I saw this before The Office, because of course this was made like a few years before it came out.
Yeah.
And so when like The Office like started becoming a huge hit, I was like, oh, look at Fish Boy. Good for him. Like he made it. Fish Boy made it.
Make it, anybody can.
Exactly. But I always thought that was really interesting that like out of everybody, like he sort of became like this breakout person, which I think is a testament to sort of a lot of Rainn Wilson's sort of sly comedy.
Yes.
Because he sort of has these dry undertones to what he does a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and I just, there's like certain sequences in that movie that like, you know, not a lot scares me, but it definitely will like, I get tense. And the sequence when they're driving out of the Firefly compound and all of a sudden the scarecrows come down and I was just like, oh my, like it's still, oh, like I still catch my breath. And it's, and I will say like, I think Bill Moseley's great as Otis in this one, but I think he's much better in Devil's Rejects. Like,
okay, I'll watch Devil's Rejects.
Devil's Rejects is more of like a Western horror. And by the end of it, you're going to be really surprised because you are going to find yourself sympathizing with the Fireflies.
Oh, all right.
It's really, really great. I honestly think that's Rob's best movie. Although I remember sitting in a theater next to a tiny child while watching it. And I was like, I get it. You're here with your cool mom or cool lady or whoever, but like, this is a lot for like, I mean, he was little, like feet barely went over the edge of the seat. Little.
Oh no.
Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I get it. Wow. Also, whoa. But yeah, I, you know, this is definitely his more extreme movie and more carnival-esque, a little more over the top, but there are certain aspects of it that have really grown on me over the years. Like I still think of that scene when Walt Goggins and Tom Tolles show up at the house and Walt Goggins is in the back and Bill Moseley like makes him get on his knees and you just sit there in that.
Yes.
Like that was intense. So unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to think of movies that have really done things like that in the last 20 years. And there aren't many.
Right.
And I also can't believe that this movie is almost 20 years old. It just sort of dawned on me in a few years. We're going to be talking about the 20th anniversary of this movie. Oh,
that's what I wrote something about Creepshow being almost 40 years old. And I was like, oh gosh.
Oh my gosh. It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's so much.
So lastly, your last pick, Silver Bullet. Corey Haim and werewolves.
Yes. Oh my gosh. This was like one of my absolute favorites. Of course, as I mentioned, I'm a huge Silver King. I'm a huge Stephen King fan. And when I was growing up, I absolutely loved the Coreys. I had a wall of Coreys in my bedroom where it was like, because you get all those little teeny bopper magazines. And so I was, every picture of Corey Haim and Corey Feldman I could find, they went on my wall. And it was a wall of Coreys. And even though I loved both of them, I always preferred Corey Haim.
Oh, that was going to be my next question. Were you more of a Feldman or a Haim fan?
I was more of a Haim.
So was I.
Really was. There was just like something really endearing and really accessible about him.
Yes.
Like Feldman's cool. Like he was like the cool Corey, like the cool, you know, the guy who like had all, like, he just seemed like the guy who could have like all the connections and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and Corey Haim was just like the likable kid who just wanted to have fun.
Yes.
But I just remember, like, again, renting this movie as a kid. The only thing I knew about it, that it had werewolves. My mom didn't have Cycle of the Werewolf, so I didn't really get exposed to that until I was older. And I just remember like absolutely falling in love with everything about Tarker's Mills. Like, I love stories about like small communities where everybody feels like they have a full life lived.
Yeah.
That to me is like, when you can create a movie like that, like, or a story like that, like, I'm so in. I think that's one of the reasons, like, I don't know if you, have you watched Midnight Mass yet?
Yes.
Oh, speaking, I mean, I won't go into too much because I don't want to read anything, but like, speaking of some Stephen King vibes, that's my favorite thing about Midnight Mass is like, within that first episode, you feel like you've lived a life with all of these characters. Like, everybody has a story. And so for me, like, Silver Bullet was just it. Like, it was, you know, it was Corey Haim and Gary Busey, who I also grew up loving as a kid.
And he's fantastic in this. He's so good as Uncle Red.
Yes, he so is. And I get so mad at people when they like dismiss him as like this crazy kooky guy. And I get it now. Like, he has brain trauma, so he's a little out there now. But like, when I was growing up as a kid, like, Gary Busey was like a serious actor. Like, he was, well, like, he was Oscar nominated for Buddy Holly. And which is a movie we watched a lot because my mom loved Buddy Holly. So like, you give me a movie with like Corey Haim, a funny uncle played by Gary Busey, and you've got like Everett McGill being the scariest reverend ever. And just all these like larger than life, like character actors and things like that. Like, it's just, it's perfect. And I love the fact that it culminates on Halloween night.
Yes.
And to me, I'm just like, well, you know, and it's one of those movies I watch year round regardless, but it feels a little extra special in October.
Yeah.
And it may not have the best werewolf, but that's okay. I don't need it.
We've got The Howling and American Werewolf in London for that. So
exactly. There's plenty of other good looking werewolf movies out there. Like, I find that he looks like a giant teddy bear, because you know what? The scenes when they shoot in reverse with when at the end of the movie, when the hair is receding and stuff, totally blew my mind as a kid.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter. Like, I bought in all of it, you know, and I think it's kind of its charm, but, yeah, it was interesting because, like, I know initially, like, Don Coscarelli was supposed to be the director for it, and something went awry. Yeah, and so Daniel Attias came in and took over. So I've always wondered what Don Coscarelli's version of that movie would look like.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I'm waiting for the day that we're going to get a new version of this story, like, in terms of an adaptation.
Right. But
we haven't yet, so I'm okay.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing those. They were, really enjoyed watching the two that I hadn't seen before.
I was so nervous too, because I know, like, Rob Zombie has this like sort of reputation, and I get it, totally get it. But at the same time, I'm like, gosh, would we do our Halloween movies? I was like, those are two that really, really set the tone for Halloween for me. And I was like, okay, I'm going to put them out there.
Hey, no,
hopefully,
that's good.
Hopefully I don't get laughed at, because you never know. But what's sort of funny to me too is, like, you know, and I'm, I get the criticisms with the Rob Zombie Halloweens. In fact, I have Fear Fest on really low right now, so that way my dogs have a little bit of noise and they don't bark. And Halloween 2007 is on right now. And I get it. And I totally get it, because I don't really love those movies very much myself. But I just think people just assume a lot of things about him and the stories that he makes. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a bummer to me, because like, I think ultimately, like, what I've always sensed is this real love for this world.
Yeah.
Like, he's a real fan. Like, and I think, and I, God, I probably get a lot of flack for this. And as much as I love Halloween 2018 and getting ready to work on my Halloween Kills review, I don't get the same sense of affection from somebody like David Gordon Green that I do from Rob Zombie. And I also think it's funny too, how so many people were coming against Rob Zombie's movies for the violence in them, which again, totally valid, because they are really, really gnarly.
Yeah.
I'm going to be really curious to see how everybody reacts after Halloween Kills, because I do think Halloween Kills is probably the most violent Halloween movie we've had to date.
Well, I feel like just even the trailer, like, I'm like, it's very violent.
It is a bloodbath. And yeah. I'm really going to be curious to see if people hold this one up to the same bar that they held the zombie movies up to. Or if it's going to get a pass because it's not him.
He's not Rob Zombie. Interesting.
Yeah. So
I'm going to watch for that now.
Yeah. I'm going to be on the lookout. Believe me.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand not liking things, and that's fine. I just always, I hate when people, if somebody doesn't like something that you like, there's no need for them to, like, you know, shit all over it. Like,
yeah, it's one of the, it's like, we all have things we like and all things that we don't like.
Yep.
Like, you know, for example, it was interesting. There's this whole thing going around recently over the last few days about this guy who wrote this article. Speaking of Midnight Mass, about
on how, Vox.
Yeah. About how he felt alienated because he's an atheist and this wasn't a story specifically written to him. And I was like, what made you think a story specifically set within the boundaries of Catholicism was going to be representative of atheism, like, in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah.
Like, every promo picture was of Father Paul. Like, I don't understand what you thought this was going to be. And frankly, if you come out of that movie thinking that it's celebrating Catholicism, well, then you really need to have your head examined, because I think you kind of missed a huge chunk of the purpose of that story. And it's interesting, because, like, I'm somebody who grew up, my family was Pentecostal. And I'm agnostic now. Like, I don't know what I believe. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily believe there's a guy sitting in a cloud up in the top manipulating everything. But I don't know that there's not anything beyond this life either. So it's like, you know, one of those things. But I think for me, the one thing that I took away from Midnight Mass, and I'm curious if you, like, what your perspective was, but, like, I think people get faith and religion mixed up too much. Mm-hmm. And I think you can have faith in things without having to be religious. And I think people forget that sometimes.
Yes.
And I think Midnight Mass for me was sort of this perfect celebration of being able to have faith in a world that maybe feels, you know, where you don't necessarily believe in a higher being. And that final scene.
Yes.
Like, I still get ready to cry every time I think about it. Mm-hmm. So.
I would agree 100%. And I grew up as in the Anglican church, but now I would say I'm an atheist. And but first of all, did not feel alienated by it at all, because I recognized that, like you said, I knew going in what it was going to be about. I mean, well, obviously not all of what it was going to be about, but it was obviously going to be a meditation on religion and faith and the church. And I thought it was so powerful. And like you said, that last scene, the monologue, which other people, like, people were also complaining about how long the monologues were.
Oh, I could have watched like 5 hours more of them.
Same. I was like, those were some of the most poignant and powerful moments of the show.
Yeah, they really were. Like, if Flanagan does not get some sort of writing Emmy for this show, like, there's seriously no justice in the world. And I'm not usually somebody who's like, oh, genres movies need to be, or genre stories need to be on this, considered alongside the other things. But, like, the writing in this series specifically is so profound it moved me in ways I wasn't expecting, again, because I'm not really somebody who's religious, but I was just like, I came away just feeling all these sort of things and contemplating things that I just had not expected.
I also have not hated a character as much as I hated Bev.
Oh my God, Bev is the worst.
In a very long time.
Like, she is the best, but she is the worst. Like, that actress, I forget, Sarah something, I'm forgetting her last name, but oh my God. Like, she is, like, so good at being hateable.
Oh.
Like, oh my God. And we all know a Bev. We've all known a Bev in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, she, to me, it's unfortunately, she is, like, one of the most relatable characters because we all know somebody like her, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Regardless of where you come from. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on to chat about your book and about Halloween movies and other things as well. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I was so excited to get to connect with you for this, and I think it's awesome. And I love that I got to introduce you to some movies. And, you know, if you ever want to do this again, I'm totally game. Book or no book.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Excellent.
Tell us where we can find you and tell us more about the book release.
Yeah, absolutely. So pretty much all of my writing you can find over at Daily Dead. Sometimes I have things pop over over at Fangoria as well. And in terms of social media, I pretty much just only hang out on Twitter. So I'm over there at The Horror Chick. And for Monsters, Makeup, and Effects Volume 1, there's a pre-sale going on for it right now. And actually, if you order it specifically through the publisher's website, they're already starting to ship out copies, which is kind of awesome. I wasn't expecting that.
Nice.
I'm still waiting on some of my copies. So I wanted to make sure like everybody else was getting those because I didn't realize this, that there's a lot of delays in publishing because of the pandemic and having raw materials to make books out of. It's a really, really scary and awesome time to be putting out books, I think, because I was told like, you know, if there could be some delays and things like that. Like if I order copies for myself right now, it's going to take about a month till I get them. So I told them I wanted to make sure that all the pre-orders got sort of, you know, got pushed ahead.
Right.
To make sure, you know, because I appreciate the support. And so if you want to pre-order that, you can go over to aminkpublishing.com and it's under their Dark Ink label. And it's, or if you go to like the /monster/makeup-effects, like I think it pops up there too. So, but yeah, so you can pre-order it there. It's also on Amazon now as well, but I think it might actually even be on sale on the AM Ink website right now as well. So you can even save a few bucks while you're at it.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So that's pretty much it, I think, for me.
Perfect. Well, thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCats the podcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.